All right, welcome to the Free Stretch here on JoeBucksFan.com. Week 2 edition of the show, 1-0 edition of the show as the Bucks get their win in the opener up in Atlanta. Bobby Fenton here with you as we get set for Monday Night Football this week, an extra day to prepare for the Bucks, an extra day to rest injuries, an extra day for you to listen to the show, which means now all through Monday my show is still good up on the site there. And it's going to be fun, always fun in prime time. We'll talk about Monday Night Football a little bit on the show. I'll tell the Monday Night Football story about the first one we had in my lifetime back in 1998 and all that good stuff. But mainly today, before we preview the Texans matchup, just want to look at what we know about the Bucs team that we saw on Sunday, what we didn't know after the preseason. And like I always say, you know, football season's a small sample size sport, and you get all these little data points throughout the year, but just one at a time, and you have to wait a week for the next one. So when you only have one to go on, and that's all you have to go on, you tend to overanalyze it a little bit. And yeah, I think there are a lot of things we can take from Sunday that tell us things that we're not being reactionary by kind of making a response to. And it was one of those games. And listen, I say this all the time when we play the Falcons. I mean, it's always something in those games. They're very frustrating to watch, quite frankly, whether the Bucs win or lose. And in this case, they were able to come out on top. And I'm still shocked, to be quite honest, because if you're a Bucs fan who's been watching this team for any amount of time, it's probably kind of in your DNA by now to expect something to happen, especially up there. And it did. And there were about 25 different moments in that game where it could have gone either way. And I'm still, you know, like very relieved, more than happy that they won. But this goes back to what I said last week when we were talking about preseason expectations and talking about the Bucks' potential spectrum of records they could have. And I said that I never do predictions, more like windows, where what's the worst record you could see, what's the best record you could see. And the reason I do that is because the NFL is just so, again, small sample size. Like that game on Sunday, I can think of literally probably 10 or 15 different instances where if you change one little iota of a thing, then the Bucks either lose or at the very least they're still playing and they go to overtime. Antoine Winfield Jr., okay, play of the game, and even though it came very late in the game and there were a bunch of plays in that game, play of the game. First of all, it's really nice to have him back, and when I say back, he didn't miss last season, but he didn't feel like himself, and he didn't feel like the guy we drafted. He didn't feel like the guy the Bucks had in his early years on the team. It felt like he took a step back. And it's only one game so far this year, but that's the Antoine Winfield Jr. I'm used to seeing. And that play that he made to come over and break up what looked like a sure completion inside the 10-yard line, which would have given the Falcons a chance to attempt the game-tying field goal from much, much closer than they eventually did and eventually missed. If he doesn't do that, that game is tied. The Falcons may even score a touchdown, but it's at the very least tied and they're still playing. Huge play by him, and he had a good game overall. It wasn't just that one play. But really liked what I saw from him. The defense in general stood up all day long, and it wasn't all perfect, but 20 points you'll take every single time, especially with this offense, and they got it done. Hassan Reddick, his Buccaneer debut, he showed, okay? Besides the actual sack he had, he was affecting plays. There was pressure, he was influencing plays, and the Bucs pass rush overall was and continues to be something that I'm concerned about. But at least he, and they need to finish, you know, like they got to Penix a little bit. They got pressures, they altered plays. Penix, to his credit, is really good at getting out of the pocket and making plays, either keeping a play alive or running, and he did that very frustrating, and he did it a few times. And there were a few times I thought Yaya Diaby lost contain, which obviously your number one thing is to rush the passer, but I hate when the pocket, like when the end just crashes down and just collapses one side. Even if you are going to win that inside move, the quarterback's just going to sidestep, and he's got all kinds of room to run. That happened a couple of times. But they were at least getting a little bit of pressure. I want to see more finishing, of course. We all do. But Hassan Reddick had a good game, I thought, and he's going to need to be that guy. He's going to need to be explosive, fast twitch. And so far, at least, it looks like he might be. Vita Vea was wrecking shop, like always. The Bucs' run defense, in general, was just absolutely wrecking shop. Both run defenses did, because the Bucs didn't run the ball for spit either. But man, the run defense for the Bucs, I mean, and this is with Bijan Robinson, who did beat him on a screen pass. That's not technically a running play, but they kept him in check. They kept the whole thing in check, and it was encouraging to see. And it's something that, with a suspect Texans offensive line coming up on Monday night, you know, the Texans may need to put it all on C.J. Stroud and his arm. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But wanted to mention what the Bucs were able to do up front there on defense. Servacia Dennis, that was another one I was watching. And with him, he was the big focal point because last season, even though he was a rookie then and came in only for a game and a fraction of another game, the defense looked really good those first two games, the two games he played in. And then when he went out, the Bucs defense, especially in pass coverage, and especially the linebackers in pass coverage, started to not look so good. So we all made the natural equation in our head, well, they're missing Servacia Dennis badly, even though we didn't really have anything to go on. I mean, he was literally six, seven quarters into his NFL career. But we just assumed he was a huge loss, and that now that we were going to have a full season of him, everything was going to be fine, the ship was going to be righted. And I'll tell you what, he was really good in run defense, but he actually wasn't very good in coverage, which was supposed to be the whole thing. I was unimpressed in that department with him. And I'm not even talking about, I know the screen pass on the third play of the game when the Falcons took the 7-0 lead. Hey, you never want to be that guy in the open field against Bijan Robinson. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're a safety, a corner, you know, a linebacker. I'm not even going to say, like, a few people were tweeting, and I had a couple of my buddies text me, Dennis takes a bad angle and gives up the touchdown. Yeah, there aren't a lot of good angles in that situation when, again, the whole, I mean, good play design, I guess, but the whole area is cleared out. You're one-on-one with Bijan Robinson in the open field. Sideline isn't close enough for you to use it as another defender, and I, you know, would have liked to have seen him get there, I guess, of course, but I don't think it was much he could have done there. But over and over, the Bucs were still lacking in coverage at the linebacker position. So it's a work in progress there. And even Todd Bowles actually took Dennis off the field for a bit there, and he was seen on the sideline. I don't want to say berating him, but he was a little bit, you know, he was letting him know that he needed to do better. And so, again, the guy's only playing his third NFL game. He's not, he'll get better. And athletically, he's still not that guy. The Bucs don't have that guy at linebacker who's just a fleet-footed linebacker who's going to cover anybody he needs to cover. But he'll do better. He did a good job in run defense. I mean, he made some plays to redeem himself in that second half. Had a batted down pass in pass rush. Made a couple of sticks on run defense. And, you know, it wasn't a bad game from him. I'm just noting that we all just assigned him, hey, good cover linebacker, guy we needed. And that may or may not be true. We'll have to keep watching as they proceed this week against the Texans. On offense, hey, not Baker Mayfield's best day, right? But I'll tell you what, that's exactly what you want in your quarterback, is a guy who can at least somehow find a way to get it done on not his best day. If you want to get deep inside the analytics and the numbers, and I know some of you like this stuff and some of you don't, but it really does tell you things that your eyes don't necessarily tell you. The offense averaged only 4.6 yards per play. That is not good. Okay, overall. Didn't get anything going early. They did a lot better in the second half. Baker had a 0.3 EPA per play. That was 11th of the 32 quarterbacks from week one. So not terrible. Upper third, barely. Well, almost, but yeah, not bad. The Bucs were negative 3.3% in their expected completion percentage versus expected. So they completed just a few percentage points lower than what you'd expect based on the passes and the openness of the receivers and all those sorts of things, which honestly I think reflects well on Josh Grizzard, who actually was able to get the offense, even though it wasn't their best day and even though they were kind of semi-unlucky a little bit, got the offense moving and completed the passes they needed to complete to get things up the field. Did it all without much of a running game because nobody could get their running game going. So hats off to Grizzard there. And Baker, you know, you're going to see the box score, and this is why you have to look a little deeper. No interceptions, which was that's a big one with him. I mean, hey, you didn't throw any interceptions. He took care of the football. Yes and no. There's a thing called turnover-worthy plays, and it's really the stat you have to look at more than actual turnovers, because sometimes you throw a ball right at somebody's chest, and they drop it. And that goes for defenders as well as receivers. So if you throw a ball right at someone's chest and they drop it, you did the same thing that would have counted for a pick if he had caught it. Your action was the same. You just get lucky that you don't get charged with a pick there. And the other side is true, too. Sometimes you throw a really good pass and there's a deflection or the receiver has it go off his hands and they pick that off. And you do get charged with a pick, even though you didn't do anything of the sort to get the ball turned over. So turnover-worthy plays measures that. I just say, okay, what? Here's a turnover-worthy throw. This throw should have been a turnover. If you just count those, you get a pretty good idea. So 11% of Baker Mayfield's throws were turnover-worthy throws on Sunday. That is high. It was the second worst of anybody in the NFL on Sunday. And yet the Bucs, through a little bit of luck, and some of it is to their credit, and Baker to his credit, didn't actually get the ball picked off, and it made a big difference. So, like I said, and he was the first one to say it in his post-game interview. It wasn't his best day, but he did some good things too. I mean, both of the touchdown passes to Emeka Abuka, we'll get to Abuka in a second, both of the touchdown passes to him were phenomenal throws, especially the first one, Emeka Abuka's first ever NFL touchdown catch, which it looked like it was going to get picked off, and then you see the end zone angle, and it just goes right over the fingertips of the safety coming over. I mean, just a freaking dart, and Abuka reels it in. Awesome, awesome stuff. And then, of course, the game-winning touchdown, what proved to be the game-winning touchdown, one that Abuka said after the game, he kind of lost in the lights briefly, and you can kind of tell by watching the way he caught it. But that was right on his hands, again, above an outstretched defender. Two really good throws, and he missed some other ones too. It happens, but if that's going to be your bad day, that's a pretty good way to do it. Still lead a comeback, game-winning drive, no turnovers, Bucks win. We can live with that for a bad day from Baker Mayfield. And then, of course, like I said, Emeka Abuka, which sometimes there's hype, and it's still only one game, even the preseason, you go all the way back to the... And sometimes it ends up being one of those things where, oh, people talk too much too soon, and sometimes it's, well, the hype got way ahead of where we should have thought he was at this point in his career. And sometimes, though, you just kind of know. And I'm not going to say anything about knowing just yet, but it really feels pretty good about Emeka Abuka, right? Like, I'm not going to get carried away after one game, but I think we got a pretty good one there. And, man, what a debut. And we saw flashes of it in the preseason. And even before that, all the things people said about him coming out of Ohio State and the way he conducted himself in camp, on the practice fields, all that stuff. So he gets two touchdowns. He's the first, what was it they said, the first one since 19, or second one since 1970, second rookie to have like the game-winning touchdown catch in week one and a two-touchdown day and made some other plays as well. And I'll tell you who was kind of an unsung hero at receiver was Sterling Shepard, man, because that was, I'll tell you, we were on the ropes and he had three big catches all for first downs, the third and nine with a minute and a half to go, which he reeled in. He went down low and got it. Again, not one of those things that after everything that happened in that game maybe is like the first two or three things you talk about, but the Buccaneers don't win that game without the play Sterling Shepard made. So with the injuries that they've had and with their, you know, a little lean at receiver right now, to see him step up as that number three guy, really, really important to know they can count on him, and he certainly was a guy they could count on Sunday. But the whole thing was a fiasco. Like, watching the game, I was completely beside myself. Typical Bucks Falcons. Like, you're pulling your hair out, you're angry, you're predicting horrible things, you know some calls or some crazy stuff's going to go against you, you know there's going to be 30 times alone in the second half where you think the Bucks are going to win and are convinced they're going to lose, you know there's going to be some sort of influence, they're reviewing calls, they're upholding calls you think should be turned over, they're turning over calls you think should be upheld, spot, the Penix play when they, on fourth down, look like they had him, then he rolls out, he dives, and he fumbles forward. Oh, it's a touchback. No, he was down for just the most Bucks-Falcons stuff imaginable. But finally, it seems like fate came through for the Bucks. And when Koo lined up for that game-winning field goal, I felt a sense of calm, honestly. It's not like I thought he was going to miss, and he's really good. But for some reason, I just felt like, I mean, first of all, if he makes it, we don't lose. We go to overtime. But second of all, I don't know, I just felt like after the Bucky face mask thing last year where the Bucks got hosed over and the interception on fourth down that they should have dropped on purpose and all the things that have happened up there, the Winfield punch out in Tampa in the second game there that should have been a touchback and they didn't get the chance to reveal, you know, all this stuff that's happened, I felt like fate owed the Bucks one yet. And I don't actually believe in fate, but for whatever reason, I was comfortable and I wasn't freaking out. And They got it done. Oh, and the offensive line. I forgot to talk about that. The converted offensive line, which we didn't know about until the game started. In fact, even in the game started, I remember I was thinking, I'm going to watch Charlie Heck at left tackle. I want to spot shadow on him, see how he's doing. So I start watching him. I'm like, not bad. He's doing pretty okay. And I'm like, wait a minute. What are these? I don't even know Charlie Heck's number, you know. And I was like, wait a minute. Is that Barton? That's Barton. And then they talked about it on the bro. Oh, here's the starting line. So, yeah, Barton at left tackle in the absence of Tristan Wirfs. Instead of just simply replacing, basically here's what they did. Instead of just replacing Tristan Wirfs with Charlie Heck, which was the plan, and I guess Heck just didn't impress them enough in camp and in the preseason. So instead of doing that, one way straight up, you change one spot on your line. They changed 60% of their offensive line, the entire left half, and instead took their center, Graham Barton, put him at left tackle, then put a substitute in at right guard instead. It was Mike Jordan, and then moved their right guard, Bredesen, to center. And it worked. Offensive line looked pretty okay. The run game certainly didn't. And then that might have had something to do with it, the shuffled offensive line. But certainly in pass protection, I thought they did a good job, and Mayfield helped with that. Such a big part of his game, man. And honestly, such a big part of the Bucs offense is Mayfield on dropbacks when there's nothing there and there's some pressure coming and he scrambles out of the pocket and just goes and gets it and goes and runs for 5, 10, 15 yards. He does that two or three times a game. It's usually always in big spots and in spots where it looked like a drive might be about to wither on the vine and die, and instead he keeps it going. And he had a couple of those on Sunday. But hats off to that offensive line and what they were able to do against the Atlanta front seven. It will not, I repeat, it will not be as easy on Monday night. As on Monday night, the Bucs visit the Houston Texans. We'll talk about that now. 7 p.m. kickoff because there are two Monday night games. I think this is good for most fans, right? Even though you like being the only game in town, they'll still be the only game on at their time because the games don't overlap like has happened in the past when they've had two Monday night games. So 7 o'clock kickoff instead of an 8:20 kickoff. I know a lot of people complain about the late kickoffs and going to bed late. Now you get all the benefits of primetime, but you don't have to start super late. I think 7 o'clock is going to be great. I know for my part, because I like to make it an event, especially now that I'm in my 40s and, you know, one of my favorite things, and a lot of guys, and a lot of you listening, hanging out with your buddies, right? Like hanging out with the boys, which in our 20s we used to watch almost every Bucks game together, no matter what time it started. But for the big ones, like for Monday night, primetime, we go to somebody's house, we get pizza and wings, you know, we do a whole thing. And now it's so hard. I tell everybody, I text all my buddies, hey man, let's do the, oh, well, my wife, this, or my kids, I got to do, my kids got flag football practice. And I have kids. I mean, it's the same stuff for all of us. But it sucks, right? Like, I want us to do stuff, to, you know, together. And so I'm hoping maybe with a 7 o'clock kickoff, some of these guys can maybe get out here and you know, come over to one game day place, and we can do it big on Monday night for Bucks Texans. But you should do that too. Use it as an excuse to get together for the game, have some fun with it. Monday night is something that if you're a Bucks fan from the past few years, even the past 15, 20 years, really going back to like the turn of the millennium and finally the Super Bowl in 2002, it's been something they've been on pretty frequently, which is nice. But if you're like me, a child of the 80s and 90s, I was born in 1980, so I grew up in the 80s and 90s. Monday Night Football was some impossible dream. That was something you watched other teams do. I couldn't even imagine what it was like for the Bucks to play on Monday Night Football for the majority of my life. I was 18 years old the first time they played on Monday night in my life, not counting like 1982 or something. I was 2 years old, but like the first time during my sentient life where I actually knew what was going on around me, 18 years old when I saw the Bucks on Monday night, and I was so pumped. Like it seemed like some impossible dream, and I to this day remember how excited I was. And I've told the story before on the show, but I'll tell it again real quick. I was a freshman in college. Now, I graduated from the University of Florida, but my freshman year, I stayed home. My mom didn't think I had gotten into the colleges I applied to, but I didn't do that great my senior year of high school. My grades were just so-so. And my mom said, no, you got to stay home for a year. So I went to USF for my freshman year. And so that semester was the fall of 1998, my first semester of ever of college. I took calculus. I think it was calculus. Can't remember. I'm pretty sure it was calculus. Class and it was Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. So the first Bucks Monday night game of my lifetime was that, I think it was December, first Monday in December, if I remember correctly, early December. So happens our final exam for that class was that night at 6 p.m. This is Monday night football when it was kicking off at like 8:30, I believe, or something like that. So you know how a college exam is. It takes, some of them take a while. And I don't just want to show up, in the middle of the first quarter. I want to soak in the tail. My whole family was there tailgating. Like, everybody's out there. I'm so pumped. It's Monday night. The lights are on. The weather's cool. There's a blimp, which we never saw a blimp in Tampa, And I was just, I was an 18-year-old kid. I was like, it was the center of my universe back then. So I remember going into this exam at USF, fully dressed in my, I'm going straight from the class to the stadium. So I'm dressed in my Bucks, polo shirt, collar shirt. I've got the whole, game getup on. I show up to class and I'm like, all right, let's do this. How in college they tell you, and they in high school too, most of the time, but they give you a syllabus and they say, okay, here's the breakdown. Homework's 20%, classwork assignments are 20%, attendance might be 10%. Then your midterm exam is 25% and your final exam is 25%. That's how we calculate your grade. And they just do a straight up equation. So you could actually, going into your final exam, you could calculate what 75% of your grade already was or whatever it was. I don't remember the exact numbers. And so you could then say exactly what you needed on the final exam to get each consecutive letter grade. So I knew going into that exam, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was something like, I think I had to get like a 38 to get a C. And I think I had to get like a, maybe a 68 to get a B, and maybe like whatever it was, maybe an 88 to get an A. Or I can't remember exactly what it was. But something like, I knew exactly what I needed for each lesson. So I knew I had a C wrapped up, probably a B. And if I really showed out, I could get an A. So I go in there at 6 p.m. My mind is nowhere near calculus. It just, I'm like, my mind's buzzing. I sit down to start taking this exam. I get a few problems into it. I realize, okay, this isn't going to happen tonight. And I'm an ADHD kid. It's hard enough for me to focus when there wasn't Monday Night Football going on. But yeah, it was one of those. So I remember doing enough just to know I had a B. I was like, I'm going to get my B. I'm not going to settle for a C. And then I was like, the A isn't happening. I'm not getting a 95 on this or whatever it was. And I said, let me just get the hell out of here. So I just blew through the second half of the exam, did just enough to clinch my B, turned it in. I think I shook the professor's hand, said, I'm getting the hell out of here. Hauled ass down I-275 to get to Raymond James Stadium. At this point, it's like 7:30, 7:45, whatever it was. And I remember just getting a little piece of the tailgate before that game and going in there. That was the night Warren Sapp sacked Brett Favre like four times in the game, and the Bucks won on Monday Night Football. Still, core memory type stuff. And so, just like I always say with all these things that have changed over the years and how much more success we have with Tampa sports now, I am never going to take it for granted. Never take Monday night for granted. Never take Sunday night for granted. Because if you grew up around the time I did, they may have thrown you a bone once every couple of seasons. Hey, we'll give the Bucks a Sunday night. Or hey, we'll give... It was never Monday night ever in the 80s and 90s, though. And then finally, after they had that really good season in 1997, they got some national notoriety. And they got that Monday night game, and now they get Monday night games and Sunday night games all the time. And it's still great. The little kid in me still gets excited in a way that I don't for a Sunday 1 p.m. game. And it's just so much fun. It's especially fun when it's at home. This one's on the road in Houston. And again, since there are two games on Monday, it's earlier, 7 p.m., so the early-to-bed crowd should like that one a little bit more. It should be wrapped up by 10:15. And if you got kids, you can let them, my son stays up till freaking 1 in the morning anyway now, but he can stay up for the game. My daughter, we'll see about that. And it should be a lot of fun. So as we get ready for the game, a couple of injury notes. Chris Godwin actually practiced today. It's the first time he practiced since that Ravens game, another primetime game. And, he was out there. You can go ahead and do it. My wife's asking me if she can fill her cup with water. So I do this from the kitchen, usually alone. But today, we got some people in the house. And she always does her best not to listen to the show, but she can't avoid it right now. So she's got the ice maker going. But either way, Chris Godwin being – this is Todd Bowles saying this. I'm recording this on Thursday afternoon right now, so they had their Thursday practice earlier. He said possible for Monday night. Now, This is his first practice. Now, he's been out there on the practice field. You saw him during camp and things like that. But this is his first time, like, really, truly participating in practice since he got hurt against Baltimore nearly a year ago. And so I think it'd be just extremely unlikely that he plays on Monday night. It's just a good sign either way, though. And there was a lot of quotes from the locker room in the post-practice media session today. Guys are just feeling good. They're buoyed, if you will, just by seeing him out there. So that's cool. And then Tristan Wirfs, same thing. Now, he's not going to play Monday. They're still saying week four, week five, or week four is the bye week, or whatever the bye, you know, right before the bye. Week five, okay, that's still good news. Although, as the Joes pointed out on JoeBucksFan.com, I'm a little worried about Wirfs because, I mean, I'm not saying he's not going to come back, but they're talking about bone on bone, and oh, no, it's fine. Stuff like that, I've heard that before. Oh, no, it's fine. And it ain't fine. Now, I'm not saying, you know, he's not going to come back or anything, but I want to see that. And there's no rush on him, even though they certainly need him. But Chris Godwin, I think maybe next week or the week after is more likely. But Todd Bowles at least left the door open for Monday night. Otherwise, Luke Goedeke, as if we didn't have already enough going on with the offensive line. He's got a foot thing. Didn't practice. They're going to see how he goes the next couple of days, which if you're listening to that, you could be listening to this anytime the next few days, but the next couple of days right now are Friday and Saturday, and hopefully he can push through it and play. We'll see about that. Benjamin Morrison, the rookie, second-round pick by the Buccaneers, he is going to be probably dressing and playing. They're going to start him out on special teams and let him, quote-unquote, get his feet wet a little bit at cornerback on the outside if they get a chance to. So those are some things to keep an eye on. But the offensive line for now, even if Goedeke does play, is going to probably look the same as it did on Sunday with Grant Barton, Mike Jordan is from left to right, Bredesen, Cody Mauch, and Goedeke, they didn't change. Although if Goedeke can't play, then you got to go Charlie Heck at right tackle when you don't want to play him at left tackle and you reshuffled your whole line, but you put him at right tackle anyway now if we get another injury if Goedeke can't go. Hopefully playing on Monday helps. But like I said, this is going to be a tougher assignment for that offensive line. You've got a Houston front seven. And I thought Atlanta's defense played really well. I give them credit. I thought they deserved some credit for the way they played. But still, this is Will Anderson, ninth in pass rushing efficiency in all the NFL last season. Daniil Hunter, also, he was 18th. You know, those two are better than any of the guys Atlanta has. And so it's going to be a challenge for the Buccaneers. And the ability to run the ball on Monday, much better than they did against Atlanta, would help a lot to kind of take some of the teeth out of that pass rush and give the Bucs a little more balance and multiple options. But either way, I'm not saying Graham Barton's not up to it. I think what he did, like I said, those guys did a great job on short notice. And you know, he's not a full season type of thing at left tackle, but as a patch, he did a really good job. So we'll see how it goes against Houston. Now, they've got injury issues too, and that could help the Bucs quite a bit. You've got, first of all, for them, their center, Jake Andrews, out for this game. And he's a good player. Anytime you lose your center, it's a big deal, period. But he's good on top of that. Their tight end, who led them in catches against the Rams, Cade Stover, he's out for this game as well. They've already got a rookie right tackle in Ariante Ursary, and he was 50th out of 53 qualifying offensive linemen in pass blocking efficiency in week one. So this is an offensive front without its center and with a weak spot at right tackle and who didn't have any success running the football in week one either. And hopefully that makes life harder for C.J. Stroud to have success against the Buccaneer defense. It should be noted, just looking at some of the numbers here, because I always like to look at the numbers. And for the Bucs, okay, here we go. I'm going to pull these numbers up. Tampa Bay's rush defense, these are courtesy of Dr. Bob Stoll, legendary handicapper. You don't have to be into gambling, though, because he has really good like analytic numbers and breakdowns of the matchups. Tampa Bay's rush defense allowed a league low negative 0.52 EPA per play in week one. So best rush defense in the league by EPA per play was the Bucs. So it'll all be on the shoulders of C.J. Stroud to move the ball through the air. He says Texans' new offensive coordinator Nick Caley, during his time in Los Angeles, had a 32% play action rate, which was the third highest during his tenure there, but he only called 11% play action in his first game with the Texans, which was last week. So that's making things a little bit harder on his offensive line. Houston's offensive line surrendered 8 unblocked pressures last week I already told you about Ariante Ursary. He'll be across from Hassan Reddick, who had a league-high 8 pressures. And then looking at, like I said, the tight end, Cade Stover. Texans tight ends had a 33% target share in week 1. That was 8th highest in the league. So C.J. Stroud now doesn't have that security blanket. I mean, there'll be a backup tight end, of course, but not quite the same. And so these are all things that no one of these things turns the entire football game, but there are little things here and there that could help the Bucs out a little bit. Not that I'm rooting for anybody to ever be hurt, but there could be some matchup advantages there for the Bucs. And the Bucs will need to get the run game going better. They had the 7th worst success rate of the 32 teams who played in week 1. And if you don't know what success rate is, it's not like anything hardcore numbers or nerd stuff for the anti-analytic people. It's simply, was a play successful? If you get 50% of the yards required on first down, that counts as a successful play. If you get 70% of the remaining yards required on second down, whatever that is. So if it's second and 10, you got to get 7 yards or more. That's successful. On third or fourth down, it's simply, did you get the first down on that play? And then was the play successful or not? So the Bucs' run game had the 7th worst. I think it was only 33%, like 1 in 3 run plays were successful. And we'll hope to see that get better. And I'm not worried about the run game in general. You know, again, Atlanta deserves some credit. And the Bucs got great performances from other places. Hey, Cam Johnson, need to mention him too, that punt return. A lot of people were like, man, what are we keeping Cam Johnson on the roster? All these receivers were lean at these other positions. And he delivered a big, big special teams play. And it ended up being something that set them up for a touchdown. And it was a big play in that game. Chase McLaughlin's another one. We can talk about the worry meter for him. I'm a little worried. I'm not going to say I'm not. Some people are like, oh, he's really good. I'm not worried at all. Yeah, kickers have bad days. That's true. I'm a little worried. Here's why. Kicking is one position, I believe it's the most of any position, that has the least carryover from year to year. In other words, like if you're a really good quarterback, then you're good. Like you're just a good quarterback. You'll be good next year, you know, barring injuries and stuff like that. You're good. Kickers can be like awesome one year or even for a few years straight and then just all of a sudden they're not good now. So there's just more randomness to it, or obviously it's a very mental position. And so Chase McLaughlin has been like a robot. Like you didn't even realize he had a personality. He's like a cyborg that rolls out there and just boots the kick through the uprights and goes back to the sideline. That's what it felt like he was. Like just a kicking robot. And so that armor got chinked a little bit on Sunday, missed a field goal. It happens. Missed an extra point on top of that. And even had that look on his face afterward, like, what the hell happened? Like he was like searching for something. And I was like, okay, I'm not gonna totally freak out right now. But you know, you just can't assume, oh, he'll be exactly as good as he's already been. The kickers are basically high variance. There's the most variance there of any position. Other positions, whatever you are, whether it's really good, decently above average, below average, or really bad, whatever, you pretty much stay around that level, at least until age starts taking over. But kickers can just be like awesome one year, even 2-3 years in a row, then they're average or worse than that. You don't know. So I'm hoping we're not due for like an average or below average year here for Chase McLaughlin. I'm a little worried. Again, not major worried about it, just a little bit worried about it right now. And then just some trends to watch overall. And I read this, didn't even realize this until I read the trend. And this is for the whole NFL, not just the Bucs Falcons. It seems like defenses are kind of evolving. I mean, everybody's evolving, but defenses are really, really, really saying, you're not going to throw deep on us. And they're really taking away the deep ball. So much so that the longest pass completed in week 1 was 51 yards, which is decently long. Actually, that might have been, was that Bijan Robinson? Was that 51? That was only a screen pass. But anyway, 51 yards, longest completion in week 1. Last year in week 1, that same length, 51 yards, would have placed as the 12th longest of week 1. And it's only a one-week thing from year to year. And again, there's a trend overall. And it seemed like points were down. I think unders, and the Bucs game was one of them. Unders were like 13-3 or 12-4. The gamblers probably know exact. I can't remember the exact number, but I read that unders were huge in general. And yeah, I mean, offense always takes a little while to get going compared to defenses, but especially in the NFL where you have preseasons and all these joint practices and all the things they can do. It shouldn't take that long. But in general, it's not the – I'm good with this, by the way. I think it's a middle ground. You don't want, like, the 90s NFL, especially if you were a Bucs fan watching Tony Dungy, where, you know, it was like a 13-10, like, rock fight. Those sucked. But you don't want every game to be 42-35. Some games are fun like that when they're every once in a while. Like the Sunday night game, the Bills-Ravens was a great game. And that ended up being, what was that, 41-40 or something like that? Which was a scoregami somehow. That doesn't seem like that crazy of a score, but no NFL game had ever been 41-40. But anyway, so that wasn't the norm. That was a wild game on Monday or Sunday night. But overall, points down. And fantasy points, I know I read this last year. For those of you that play fantasy, I don't. But just overall, fantasy points have been way down compared to past years, right? So we'll see if that trend continues as we go through the rest of the season. But in the meantime, at least the Bucs offense, they will tell you 23 points isn't going to cut it. They want more, and they're going to need more if they're going to win more games throughout the season, starting on Monday night against the Houston Texans. But that's where we're at right now. Games against Atlanta, I don't care how they look. You can do whatever you got to do. Pretty ugly, high scoring, low scoring. That's a division win on the road against the team that is considered to be the most likely threat to you in the NFC South. And I know the Bucs lost both of them the last year and still ended up winning the NFC South. And that's all well and good. That's great. But we don't want to try it that way again. So now you know at the very worst, you're going to not have the head-to-head tiebreaker go against you with Atlanta. If you can win that next one, you'll have that tiebreaker. But even if you lose it and you split, it'll go to division record. The Panthers and the Saints both didn't look great. Saints did have a chance to win at the end. But everybody else in the NFC South is 0-1. The Bucs are 1-0. That's a beautiful thing. Nothing wrong with that. So we go on Monday night to Houston, and there's no games you want to lose, but for tiebreakers and things like that, when you get down to it in December, I guess the AFC ones are the most losable ones. Not that I want to put that to the test on Monday night. We'll see how it goes against the Texans and C.J. Stroud with the Bucs. 7 p.m. Oh, it's on ABC, too, and ESPN, which doesn't make that big of a difference. Probably almost everybody has ESPN in some form, but not everybody, especially older people. You'll see, and if you want, maybe you don't care about this, but if you want the Bucs to be in front of the most eyeballs possible, and the ratings still bear this out, games that are aired on ABC or NBC or CBS or any network still get higher ratings than games that are cable only. And that's especially true. I mean, ESPN at least is a little more ubiquitous, but even ESPN, the numbers don't come close when a game is only on ESPN compared to when it's on ABC and ESPN, or just ABC itself. So the second game, which is the Chargers at the Raiders on Monday night, the 10 p.m. game, that one's only on ESPN. But Bucks at Texans will be 7 o'clock, ABC and ESPN, at least for the start. And so whatever your cable TV setup is or however you like to do things, shouldn't be any problem watching it. Like I said, make it an event, make it fun. Go to somebody's house or have people over to your house or whatever you got to do. But we are into the rhythms now. Week one in the books. Bucks are 1-0. We'll be back next week, hopefully talking about a 2-0 football team. Email me if you want to, bobbygameday@yahoo.com. You can even get the fridge schedule sent to you if you want one. Again, that's BOBBYGAMEDAY. bobbygameday@yahoo.com. On Twitter, @bobbygameday. Thanks to you for listening. Thank you to the Joes, joebucksfan.com. Single best place anywhere for Bucks coverage, TV, internet, radio. And I always appreciate the Joes giving me this platform and allowing me to be in front of you. Have a great weekend. Be safe. Have fun. And we'll talk next week. And until then, wherever you are, good morning, good afternoon, good night, and go Bucks.